Dad here, and welcome to Inside Albania with me, Alice Taylor. This week, I'm going to be taking a close look at Albania's ranking in the Freedom House Nations in Transit report, which was released this week. I'm also going to be looking at how Spain's rush and push to recognise Palestine as an independent state could or should impact Kosovo. And lastly, I'm going to be splitting hairs over a new report into the tense and ongoing situation between Kosovo and Serbia in the north of Kosovo. So this week, Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez announced that he expects his country to formally recognise Palestine as an independent country by the summer. Now, he aims also to reach a two-state solution as quickly as possible, and he is set to embark on a tour of Norway, Ireland, Belgium and Slovenia in a bid to drum up support and backing for recognition. Currently, Sweden, Malta, Cyprus, Czechia, Poland, Slovakia, Hungary, Romania, and Bulgaria recognise Palestine out of EU member states. Now, personally, I favour recognition of Palestine and a two-state solution, but I do find Spain's stance a little bit contradictory. Spain, as we've discussed in previous episodes of Inside Albania, does not recognise Kosovo's independence, and it has also said it will not. Now, it did confirm in January that they will recognise the passport, they will allow visa-free travel to Spain for Kosovo citizens, but officials have reiterated that official recognition of the country is not on the cards. Now, I'm joined today by a former guest, the UK's former Minister for Europe, Dennis McShane. Dennis, welcome. It's a pleasure to have you back on Inside Albania.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Now, let's get straight to it. Now, you've written this op-ed and you have some quite strong views, quite rightly so, on Spain's very noble push to recognise Palestine, and yet it's not recognising Kosovo. Now, you note quite rightly that the UK recognises Kosovo without it having any impact on Scottish independence bids, or Welsh, I have to say, being half Welsh myself. Canada recognises Kosovo without it impacting the situation with Quebec secessionists. The same with France and Corsica, Italy, Sardinia. We could say Belgium and Flanders, or Wallonia, Croatia and Istria. I could go on. What is Spain's excuse now?
It doesn't really have one. The problem is, the division in Spain is about the constitutional reality of Spain, and the independentistas, as they're called in Catalonia, are seen as almost enemies of the idea of Spain staying together, but in a very direct way, because Spain still, in its recent living history, was ruled by a fascist military dictator. He made a huge point of utterly suppressing anything that smacked of Catalonia, Catalan or Basque identity, the language, newspapers, teaching, just as Serbs tried to crush the idea of teaching in Albanian, Kosovo, and in Kosovo. So it is more sensitive, but it's also deeply irrational. And what happens always is, whichever party is in power, if it hints at a reasonable approach to Kosovo, the other one jumps up and says, you're betraying the identity and unity of Spain. But the Kosovo is, in my view, not done enough to educate the Spanish. It's an investment. You have to find some international help just to try and persuade influencers and decision makers that recognizing Kosovo, opening an embassy in Pristina, is not the same as saying Catalonia and the Basque country are going to disappear off to become separate nations.
This is what I don't understand. How can you recognise, how can you say we want Palestine to be recognised as an independent state, which I agree with, but then in the same breath say, no, we're never going to recognise Kosovo? Like, how can they contradict each other like that? Is it a contradiction or am I missing something?
It is a contradiction. They don't see it that way. Mm. Their argument will be, and I've had this argument again and again, and it just doesn't change much, that Kosovo was taken from Serbia thanks to superior military force, the intervention just about 25 years ago,
yes.
March, I think the 25th, 1999. And that was a military intervention and therefore was illegitimate. It wasn't fully sanctioned by the UN. The UN had passed resolutions to stop the butchery in Kosovo, the Serb mass murders that we all know about. But there wasn't a UN vote because Russia would have vetoed it, China would have vetoed it, to, as it were, create a new state of Kosovo. A lucky Israel in 1948, the UN said you can be a state, though the Israelis have gone a lot further than what was permitted by the UN.
That's one way of putting it.
I was there at the time, and it was announced, Hashim Thaçi, I think, was then the prime minister. It was announced with great pomp in America, again, very much with the United States pushing it and other European countries coming along behind, including the United Kingdom. We were strong supporters. But they hadn't really checked with all the European countries. And I remember watching television, a friend of mine who was a Spanish foreign minister, and Spain that Sunday, literally in the same week or two, Kosovo declared independence, was going into the toughest election that they'd faced for some years. And this chap came out and said Spain will never recognize Kosovo's independence, because if he'd said the opposite, he was a socialist, then the right wing party in Spain would have jumped down his throat and won many more votes. And that really is the problem. It's impossible to line up all 27 European countries, of course, but I've constantly argued that the guys in Pristina with their helpers in Washington don't pay enough attention to European politics and changing the mentality in the European capitals.
Now, when I was, you know, mentally struggling with understanding this, and I thought maybe if Spain recognizes Palestine, and they can recognize Palestine without it impacting their view of Catalonia and everything, could that be a precedent in Spain for them to then recognize Kosovo? I thought, are they playing a game here? What do you think?
Well, it obviously is a precedent when you recognize a country that doesn't actually control a state or have a democratically elected parliament and so on and so on and so on. I mean, we all emotionally support the idea of a state of Palestine, but strictly speaking, in international law, you recognize states that have got an agreed frontier and have legal jurisprudence over that country. Doesn't necessarily have to be a democracy, but there is an acceptance of borders and that country is ruled by the government there. Now, that's not the case.
No.
The occupied West Bank, we don't have to go into Israel details. We all know them by heart. So recognizing Palestine is more in the territory of diplomatic gestures. But nonetheless, it is international law. It is a significant step forward. I agree with Pedro Sanchez. I think that is a good decision by Spain. Were I a Spaniard, I would be supporting him. And I just hope somebody realizes that Spain could be a much bigger player in Europe if it was lined up with the big European players, namely in the EU, Germany, France, Italy, Netherlands, and Poland, in the broader Europe, have to sort of have a small word for the UK, even if we're not in the EU. We are in NATO, we're in lots of other. I'm going to the Council of Europe next week, where there'll be a very important debate on Kosovo joining the Council of Europe. And indeed, that would be Spain then would have far more pull. But Spain is absent in the whole of the West Balkans. It's not just Kosovo. The West Balkans remains Europe's Achilles heel. Yes. I mean, it's, if you like, 25 years since Milosevic and Tudjman launched the great wars that devoured the West Balkans, ending up in 1999 with the liberation of Kosovo. We all know that history, but very few Europeans do. I do think Kosovo should spend more time on just educating the rest of Europe into its existence. The fact, there are a lot of tensions. Yes, there are problems with the Serbs in the north, but there are plenty of cities and towns and communities where the Serbs live peacefully side by side. Mm-hmm. Serd, Orthodox religion, especially in Peña, in Pech, is fully respected and admired. And the best beer in Kosovo is brewed there, in my humble opinion. And so it is time just to let Kosovo be Kosovo. It'll be imperfect. There'll be tensions. There'll be accusations of corruption. People hate Kurti. Other people don't like the war parties. Yes, yes, yes. Welcome to European politics. That happens in every country.
Now, my last question. We are both in Strasbourg next week. I hope we get to meet in person. There is a very important resolution vote coming up to do with Kosovo in the Council of Europe plenary around the 75th anniversary of the body's establishment. What do you expect to come out from next week?
Well, big fingers crossed. I mean, I did urge Kosovo to lobby very hard in the Council of Europe. It's done so, I think, with support of Britain, certainly, but other countries too. There's a very strong statement by Frank Schwaber, who is the German Social Democrat. He is chairman of the socialist group of delegates, parliamentarians of the Council of Europe, 2-3 weeks ago, urging everybody to support the resolution accepting Kosovo as a Council of Europe member. I'm not picking up rumours against. Obviously, the Serbs have said, Vucic has said, oh, I'll walk out of the Council of Europe. Well, goodbye, Alex. You can go and join.
It's not an airport. Putin. You don't have to announce your departure.
You can go and join Mr. Putin, Mr. Lukashenko. If you really think that does Serbia any good at all, be my guest. Yes. So, but we'll see. I mean, there will be the Greeks, the Cypriots, obviously the Spanish. I'm not sure the non-recognizers in the EU, because the Council of Europe is bigger than the EU. It's got Norway and Switzerland and indeed had Russia in it and all the Balkan states. So I do hope that finally Kosovo will be admitted and can take a full part in the Council of Europe's work and deliberations.
I hope so too. I did read something actually. The German representative of the Council of Europe had said something, oh, Kosovo should establish the Association of Serb Municipalities before we could, you know, but I'm not convinced that that's going to pick up enough traction to derail.
I mean, again, I've talked to people on that. I mean, Mr. Kurti has got a very strong position. He thinks that that would be a bit like Republika Srpska in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Be serious. I mean, the Serbs are a giant, a very significant part of the population of Bosnia-Herzegovina. In Kosovo, they're a minority, a small group. I mean, important, but they live, they can play a full part in Kosovo. I'm not sure that establishing, I know that makes people in Pristina nervous. Frankly, you know, if they wanted to create an association of Irish municipalities in England or Scottish-run
Welsh
municipalities in England, we wouldn't worry, but you know, we've been around for 200 or 300 years with a more stable democracy, so we're not too don't get too up about that. So everybody agrees, I think, that Mr. Kurti's position, for which I have some sympathy, he is a very principled man, very intellectual man, and he has been elected by the people of Kosovo, so he has to speak for them and for what he himself believes in. Alice, I hope, as a former delegate to the Council of Europe, a big supporter of the Council of Europe, that this time next week we can celebrate Kosovo joining.
I hope so too. Your words are very correct. I couldn't have said it better myself. Good luck to Kosovo next week, and I'll see you in Strasbourg.
See you in Strasbourg.
Thank you. Now on to Serbia and Kosovo. At the start of April, an NGO, International Crisis Group, published a report taking stock of the situation in the north of Kosovo in the context of Serb minority rights, their relationship with Pristina, their relationship with Serbia, and Kosovo's relation with the EU and the US. Now, the report has given an overview of the situation, the arguments of both sides, what the EU and the US are saying, and it suggests possible ways forward. Now, it focuses on the Serb minority in the north, the incidents that have plagued the last 2 years, and the attempts by international allies to mediate. But I do have a few questions about the findings of this report. I invited the Crisis Group's senior Western Balkans analyst, Marko Prelec, to discuss them. Marko, welcome to Inside Albania. For those watching who've not had a chance to read your report, I'm wondering, can you give us an overview, as briefly as possible, but an overview of the report, its aims, and the main findings and recommendations and outcomes, please?
Sure, and thanks for inviting me here. The report is about the Serb minority in Kosovo, and specifically the ones who live in northern Kosovo, which is a very heavily Serb-majority area, about their relationship with the Kosovo government, and also about the bilateral relationship between Kosovo and Serbia. The conclusion, the sort of headline message that we have, is that Pristina has been winning the battle, so to speak, to integrate the northern Kosovo Serbs and to bring them under its authority and to integrate them into the broader Kosovo administrative state, something that it's been struggling to do ever since the Republic declared its independence in 2008, so 16 years now. Mm-hmm. So that is happening. On the one hand. On the other hand, we fear, although it's too early to say this definitively, but we fear that the signs are that Kosovo is losing the war for its own integration into the international community, insofar as that goes through a resolution of its dispute over its independence with Belgrade. The Kosovo Serb minority is one of the, and possibly the main, keys to unlocking the broader Kosovo-Serbia impasse. And insofar as it ceases to be a factor through immigration, predominantly immigration, demoralization, brain drain, it will be very difficult for future administrations in Pristina and Belgrade to find a way to reconcile. And what we really call on Pristina to be generous to these people. They are a very highly vulnerable minority that it is now responsible for, and that's our headline recommendation. Be nice to them.
My first question, and I'm glad you said it again. You used the word battle and you used the word war, and I don't know what because you used this on Twitter as well, and I feel that this rhetoric of sort of fighting, conflict, why use those words when we're talking about this situation, which is highly volatile, and everyone really has an interest in keeping from getting more volatile?
Yeah, it's just a metaphor, really. It's just a neat metaphor, you know, and the implication really is not that it's a military confrontation. It's that there's a smaller thing that's going on that Kosovo is succeeding in, and a larger thing in maybe in the background that it's failing at. That's really all that we were trying to say. There is a militarized component to this, though. Mm-hmm. There has been violence. There has been loss of life in northern Kosovo over the course of last year, and there is some possibility that it could happen again.
Yes, this is a concern. Now, I want to talk about the Serb minority. Of course, there are issues with the Serb minority and how they integrate within society. A lot of them do not recognize Kosovo as a sovereign state. They recognize Belgrade. We know there is pressure coming from Belgrade on them as well. Maybe there is also pressure coming from Kosovo. But from what I understand, if you read the Kosovo constitution, minorities in Kosovo are some of the most well protected on the European continent, particularly Kosovo Serbs as well, in terms of getting access to healthcare and schools. They had free electricity, not having to pay so many taxes, having designated seats in parliament, in the municipalities, in the police. You know, there's a whole range of, and I see this, you know, Kosovo is being pressured. You have to give them more rights, you have to do this, but what else does Kosovo need to do?
Yeah, that's true on paper. They do have you know, really a very generous set of rights that were assigned to them by the international process, led by Martti Ahtisaari, mm-hmm. that led to Kosovo's independence. And it was kind of a quid pro quo. You know, you'll give the Serbs these rights that you're not really keen on giving them, and in return we will back your independence. A lot of those rights are either not implemented in ways that make any difference to your average Kosovo Serb. So if you start with political representation, which you mentioned, yeah, they do have a disproportionate number of seats in the Kosovo Assembly, but and this is actually not the fault of any Kosovar actors, it's the fault of Serbia. Those representatives are de facto chosen for them by the government in Belgrade, and they represent the interests of Serbia, not of the Kosovo Serbs. Mm-hmm. And increasingly over the past few years, the Kosovo Serbs have lost faith in their own representatives. So that's one thing. They do have the right to schools in their own language and to healthcare. However, those rights are not implemented. Instead, the schools they have are schools that Serbia operates technically illegally on Kosovo territory. So it's not quite the same.
We saw the attack, the EU called it a terrorist attack in the north of Kosovo on the 24th of September. I noticed the report didn't call it attack as well. It called it a clash between police and Serb paramilitaries. But I think this serves as a clear example of what can happen, you know, and what can go wrong. Now, the EU has... I mean, the Kosovo government said they've given a report to the EU, all the evidence that they collected. The EU said they haven't had a report. Nothing's really happened. I mean, it's going to be a year since the attack before we know it. What importance do you think this incident has in relations? And do you think the EU are doing enough to sort of deal with the consequences of it?
That has been a turning point because it swung. I mean, up until that point, there was a lot of European and indeed also American sympathy that had accrued to the Kosovo Serbs, because of the increasing pressure that they were under from the government of Kosovo ever since Albin Kurti and the Vetvendosje party came into power. That evaporated overnight when it became clear that there were these preparations for some kind of armed insurgency involving, attacks on Kosovo police who, you know, were legally operating up there.
Yes, yes.
So immediately people said, okay, we now have no choice but to support Kosovo's efforts to use its police and its, you know, highly provocative special police forces in that territory.
But nothing's happened. It's months later. No one's been, Serbia has not been, the EU won't even talk about it. You know, we were promised that following their assessment of the final report and the investigation conducted by the Kosovo authorities, there would be some, that there were measures drafted against Serbia, but nothing. Now, if I contact the EU about this topic, they don't reply. They do not even respond to comments. Why is this happening? Yet they're so harsh on Kurti, rightly or wrongly aside.
Yeah, they are. Look, I'm not... I'm not in a position to interpret the EU's actions, so I think it would be unfair for me even to try to answer that. I guess what they are trying to do is calibrate their statements and their actions to what they best believe will lead to a good outcome.
Calming the situation.
Calming the situation. That's probably what they're trying to do. Whether they have the right mix or not, I can't really say.
In the report, it's mentioned the Serb boycotts of the government institutions. Now they walked out of institutions. They resigned. They refused to then take part in elections. Belgrade asked citizens not to vote. Then there was an election with a very small turnout. Albanian mayors were voted in. They refused to accept them. There was the protests, the confrontations. NATO peacekeepers were hurt. Then they demanded they were removed and they called for new elections. This now appears to be happening. And now they say they're not going to take part. I at the moment, I feel a bit lost. You know, what are these people speaking for actual Kosovo Serbs here? Is this what they want? What do they want in this process? Because it seems they've called for XYZ. XYZ has happened. And then they're saying they're not going to take part. And in the census as well. It's in their interests.
I don't blame you for feeling baffled. it is baffling. There is an important bit of background here, which is that in northern Kosovo, the population broadly has not wanted and still does not want to engage with Kosovo politically. Okay, so they don't want to vote in Kosovo elections. They want Serbia to come back. Okay, that's what they want. It's not going to happen. So they basically, you know, up until November of 2022, when the Serb representatives and officials, you know, police and lawyers and judges and everyone who was working in Kosovo institutions, when they all resigned, they were not told to do that by Belgrade. They had been asking to do that for months and, in fact, possibly years. And they were finally given a green light to do that. So it was something that they wanted to do. They were then told to come back again by Belgrade, and they agreed to do so. And then for some reason, which I cannot really speculate on, they've now pulled out. Probably it has to do with the technical, the onerous technical procedures that the government has chosen to use for the recall referendum. There is a big problem, and this is not.
But they can't just call a vote like that for no reason. You know, there has to be.
The problem is that there is an obsolete voting list, voting register. So there's a ton of people who are on that register who do not exist anymore. They've either died or moved away. That normally would not be a problem, but because the regulation that Kosovo has put into place requires a turnout of more than 50%, it is very, very difficult to reach that turnout. So even if they, you know, if in fact well over half of the people who are there turn out to vote, it will be registered as less than half because there is this obsolete voting register, which exists in other countries. So it's, you know, I want to emphasize, this is not something that was done to
and
screw
I mean,
over.
Let's think of the Albanians in southern Serbia who've been removed from the voting list and can't vote. You know, do you see that there's a big discrepancy here?
That is something that Serbia has been doing you know, increased pressure on its own even more vulnerable and smaller Albanian minority, and that absolutely needs to be called out and criticized. So yeah, that's true.
I have one more question, and this is slightly different from the report, but I wanted to ask your expertise on it as someone who knows the region very well. I saw yesterday that Vucic, President Vucic, was in France and that they are working on a deal to purchase jets from the French government. I then saw that Dodik was in Paris as well. And I was thinking, okay, there's something going on here. Why are both of these characters in Paris at pretty much the same time? And what I found really interesting was Serbia's announcement that it's going to switch to buy fighter jets from France, whereas before it was buying a lot of military equipment from Russia. And I'm wondering, what's going on here? There has to be some, what's France doing? There's some deal going on here, and I'm sure the EU is involved. Did you see this news? Do you have any thoughts on what might be at play here?
Yeah, this is not, I've seen it, and I'm as curious as you are. I think this is not new. So Serbia has been interested in buying Rafale jets from France for some time. This is part of Serbia's sort of policy of neutrality and balancing. So they buy some things from China, they buy some things from Russia, they buy some things from Western sources. Serbia is under no illusion about where it is geographically. It is surrounded by an unbroken belt of NATO countries. So it is difficult, if not impossible, for it at this point to continue doing business with Russia, just because, you know, it's geographically impossible. They also are aware, and this is off the topic of our interview today, of intensifying Western pressure on Milorad Dodik, the leader of the Bosnian Serbs. So there presumably is lobbying going on in France and other major European capitals as we speak with regard to that.
I wish I could have been a fly on the wall in those meetings that went on. Marco, we're out of time. Thank you for being a good sport with the questions, and thank you for your report.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me again. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Bye-bye. On Thursday, Freedom House published its annual report on Albania called Nations in Transit. Now, this provides an overview into the situation of democracy, governance, the rule of law, media freedom, crime, institutional functioning, everything basically to do with society in Albania. And it then ranks the country in the region and in Europe and gives it a score and a designation. To find out more about all of this and just how Albania fared in the last 12 months, I'm joined by Alexandra Karpi, a research analyst covering the Western Balkans for Nations in Transit, to find out more about the report and, more importantly, what it means for people in Albania. Alexandra, welcome to Inside Albania, and thank you for joining us online today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, the report this year, based on the last 12 months, is pretty hefty. There's some quite serious commentary in there. It's quite somber reading. You know, when you finish reading it, you think, oh God, you know, is it really that bad? Now, from what I understand, Albania didn't improve over the last 12 months, but it also hasn't gone backwards. Can you give me an overview on the last 12 months and also how it's changed or not changed when compared to the year before?
Sure, absolutely. First, maybe it's best to just step back briefly and share some of the main findings from the report and how Albania sort of sits within that. So this year was the 20th consecutive year of overall decline in democratic governance in the entire region that we cover in the report. So a lot of bad news everywhere in the region, unfortunately. And, you know, think about that for a minute. Two decades of declining democratic governance in the Europe and Eurasia region is going to have, of course, ramifications in all of our countries. We are now seeing the region split, as the title of the main report would suggest, into two opposing anti-democracy and pro-democracy blocs. Now, what this geopolitical moment means for countries like Albania that we consider quote-unquote hybrid regimes, right, so countries that have characteristics of both democracies and autocracies, this means that increasingly governments are having to make a choice, right? Are they going to head in a more autocratic or in a more democratic direction? Albania was one of the few countries that seemed to sort of sit in two chairs a little bit, right? Hedge its bets there. It was not a quiet year, right? You know, no score changes should imply that there was not a lot of action this year. You know, on the one hand, in the beginning half of the year, of course, we had local elections last May, and this was a further consolidation of the ruling party's local hold. But we're still seeing the fallout from that, right? We just saw the news in the last couple of weeks that the Freddy Bellary case, you know, we saw that the conviction of vote buying that had taken place at the end of last year. We now saw that the caretaker head of government in the Himar municipality is also being indicted for corruption. So this is, I think, kind of gives a good snapshot of the tensions in Albania this year. On the one hand, the socialists continue to kind of be the top dogs, right? On the other hand, there are still persistent corruption concerns, which is a shame because we did see Albania make quite a bit of progress last year on our corruption indicator. But this remains, at least at the local level, rather persistent. Now, zooming out back to the national level, which really, of course, in the fall at the end of the year took center stage, there continues to be, let's say, drama in the parliament. I mean, you know, semi-disruptive protest-type actions.
Setting
I know that you've covered.
Setting fire to things.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And again, this is sort of within the realm of normal in Albanian politics, but is an indicator that the opposition has sort of run out of options in a way. And the result is that now we haven't had the opposition participate in the parliament for, what, 5 or 6 months now. So this is, of course, not the sort of normal playmaking that should be taking place in democracies. As I said, it's within the realm of normal for Albania, but this is some of the challenges that we've kind of ended the year with.
Have there been any positive developments?
I think, you know, on some parts of the fight against corruption, yes, I think you could point to some positives in 2023. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, we had SPOC, the anti-corruption structure, continue to be really proactive in fighting corruption.
Yes.
We had indictments against, you know, former presidents, former deputy prime ministers. Of course, I know you covered those as well in the last year. So that continues to be really the most, I would say, bastion for democracy, you know, the most trusted institution in Albania at the moment. That is from the perspective of citizens. Of course, we have different politicians on both the opposition and ruling party side trading accusations about SPOC. So their work is becoming increasingly politicized, but they are still doing, I think, that really important work. So these are the positives I think we can point to. And again, you know, to not see any declines in this geopolitical moment, right, and to continue to see, for the most part, democratic institutions being relatively resilient is a good sign as well.
So it's a stagnation, really. It's things, there've been some things that were better, some things that haven't been very good. So we've sort of plateaued in a way. But how do we perform in the region, sort of amongst our neighbors?
Yeah, Albania is on the slightly higher scoring end, but also sort of middle of the pack. You know, it's often paired, of course, with North Macedonia. The EU processes are linked. So institutionally, they are quite similar, despite their political scenes being rather different. But all that being said, I think Albania, if you're looking at some of the success stories, right, that we've talked about in the field of corruption, actually, in some ways, is a leader in the region. That's not to say there is still not a long way to go. And again, I am increasingly worried about how SPOC's work is being politicized. But you know, in that realm, Albania actually performs quite well for the region. You know, there are quite a bit of similarities as far as things I am worried about going into 2024, you know, increasingly looking at hostility against journalists. I know we just had this case with Edi Rama that, of course, the video was circulating where he had, you know, placed his face, however you want to describe it, had sort of lurched out at a young journalist. So this was also a trend in 2023 that I am watching very closely into 2024. So this is, you know, kind of the broader picture in the region as well. It is an increasingly difficult time, but I think Albania, for the most part, actually has some strengths to point to in the corruption sector, at least.
And this year, I mean, since the beginning of 2024, the opposition, the fragmenting of the opposition, the infighting, then the fighting in parliament, you know, this was a huge issue in 2023, but now they've come to some sort of agreement to collaborate and work together in the last few weeks. You know, they've been managing to actually pass things through parliament. Maybe this is going to improve. Maybe it will continue. Maybe it won't. They're establishing a ministry sort of against corruption as well. I mean, have you followed what's been happening this year? Are you hopeful things might pick up a bit?
Yeah, that's right. And I have been following it. I mean, I think it's still a little bit too soon to say, right? What we know about this region and about Albania is these kinds of deals. Yeah, anything could happen. And these kinds of deals, you know, what is actually given up is sometimes not immediately clear. And again, with both parties being very critical in the fight against corruption right now, you know, I would just be really careful to make sure that the independence of the anti-corruption bodies, this new ministry, if it comes to fruition, right, is really a priority, because ultimately we need those kinds of independent oversight bodies. We do, of course, need political agreement and parliamentary function, but at the same time, those things should not take precedent, right, over making sure that the bodies are independent and functioning as they should. But, you know, the international community, and particularly the U.S., has been watching very closely and has been, you know, I think both encouraging when it needs to be encouraging, but also has been pointing out the places for improvement, at least in, again, the corruption sector I can speak to. So this is positive. But let's wait and see what the real outcomes of the deal seem to be. I am sometimes skeptical about these things, but at the same time, it could really be a step forward for just the overall democratic nature of these parties and for Albania writ large.
And Albania is moving forward slowly but surely with its EU integration, and obviously every aspect of Albanian society, the rule of law, democratic institutions is technically going to come under a sort of spotlight. Do you think this is going to have a real impact on the situation here? Do you think it'll end up being a box-ticking exercise? Do you think there's political will to improve things? How do you see this process impacting the situation?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, first, you know, what is unique about Albania, which I'm sure has been said before but bears repeating, is that, you know, EU integration, or really future membership, is extremely popular. I mean, something in the 80s, 90s, when you look at public polling, which is an anomaly in this region, and frankly, an anomaly when you look at current member states. So there is at least public will, right? Public support. There is a vibrant civil society that has been working on these processes now for years. So there's a lot of local demand working in Albania's favor. It is, of course, always a question of political will, right? And different officials and the parties willing to cooperate to make those, you know, difficult reform processes happen. And this is, you know, we've seen, I think, a bit of a one step forward, two step back in Albania traditionally. I'd love to see that continue into 2024 and be, you know, continually moving forward progress. But yes, the rule of law challenges are distinct and are going to be a challenge. The need for vetting processes, right? I know Albania has started this process. These kinds of mechanisms we've seen in other Western Balkan states in the process, like Montenegro, we've seen that be a sticking point. We've seen them sort of falter. So, you know, avoiding some of those pitfalls in the rule of law sector is going to be really important to keep Albania moving. But ultimately, the possible gains are significant, right? Could be a huge boon for institutional democracy in the country. So I'm hopeful. I'm cautiously hopeful. We'll see.
I wanted to ask as well about civil society organizations. There was a note in the report that there's a lack of consultation on the part of the government with civil society organizations, little willingness from parliament to engage with them or accept suggestions. Why is this situation so bad? Why does parliament and all politicians in general not really want to engage with civil society?
Yeah, it's a complicated question. I think, you know, to be honest, I think there's a couple of different factors at play. You know, first, a lot of governments in this region, in the Western Balkans, struggle, I think, to see civil society as real partners. Mm-hmm. Part of that may be a historical kind of, you know, question, right? I think It's difficult sometimes to recognize the expertise that the civil society has, and it's significant, but it's hard to not hear that as criticism. I think that's sometimes the drawback we see in this region, and certainly seems to be part of the rhetoric in Albania. But it doesn't help that we have, on even sort of further, taking things a step further, we have this community being scapegoated in a sense, and also being deemed foreign agents and the like elsewhere in the region. You know, we've seen sort of undercurrents of that rhetorically in Albania. Luckily, we haven't seen any real legislative efforts as we've seen in neighboring countries, but there certainly is a spillover effect, right? You know, when you think about it from the perspective of politicians, if you don't see civil society as partners and you rather see them as critics, just like any critics, you might look for ways to kind of sidestep the criticism. And this is, you know, we see it again in the media sector, as I've mentioned, unfortunately. So it is something I am worried about and I'm watching. But on the other hand, I haven't seen any real legal efforts to curtail the civic sector. And that's really important. Ultimately, they still have some operating space. They still have financial challenges, which is true, frankly, everywhere, not just in the Western Balkans and not just in Albania. But, you know, it's a difficult question to, you know, how you get governments to see them as partners. This takes a very, very long time, right? A very, very long time. The EU process can help with that because there has to be a level of collaboration, but it's a slow go. You know, it takes some time.
Now, in terms of the reports, you know, when these reports, it could be Transparency International, it could be Reporters Without Borders, you know, as soon as they're published, the opposition and the critical media, and, you know, they go, oh, look at this, it's really bad. This government did this, they did this, they didn't do this. The government goes, well, actually, it was like that when we took over. It was your fault. And they say, oh, the report's not accurate. It's too negative, blah, blah, blah. And they just tend to fight over trading blame over who did what, who was responsible for what, etc., rather than the actual sort of salient points. How do you wish that the governments in these countries would accept these reports? You know, what is the aim of them? How do you want them to deal with the information inside them?
Yeah, that's a great question. And thank you for that, because you are right. You've described accurately what happens in our day to day. And on the other hand, you know, if they have a score improvement, suddenly, you know, they're the best performing government, their cabinet they've ever had. So it does go both ways. Look, I mean, ultimately, you know, our report is does provide some sort of, let's say, fodder for technical recommendations for reform. It's not deeply, deeply technical, obviously. It has to be high level by the nature of it. But it should pinpoint, I would say, vulnerabilities for democracy, right? So it pinpoints not only, you know, trends that we should be concerned about as far as the performance of particular politicians or governments. It's not really what we measure, ultimately. We're measuring the strength of institutions, right? So it's looking at what institutions maybe need shoring up, where we need to be looking at greater efficacy or greater independence and those kinds of measures. And keep in mind, too, it can be a comparative tool. So and I know that I'm sure that's very difficult to receive by governments, but it could be, you know, oh, okay, you know, Montenegro is performing well in this area. Perhaps there is something to be learned there. Perhaps there are some different models we can take from there. And you know, maybe there are relationships that could be built in the region that are, you know, positively oriented towards institutional reform. So, you know, as much as Nation Transit, it can sometimes be seen as an academic tool, it also can, I think, really be a starting point for discussion in the region about what institutional change can really look like and how we do go about rebuilding democracy, given the fact that all countries in this broader region are struggling now for, again, two decades of declining institutional governance. So, you know, there's a lot to be learned here, I think, if politicians can be open-minded.
I like that what you said about the regional sort of impact it could have, you know, to sort of stoke a bit of healthy competition between countries to get to the top rather than the bottom, which is what seems to have happened over recent years. Alexandra, yes. Thank you very much for your time and for explaining this report to us. Let's hope that the positive ish developments we've seen in 2024 will continue, and hopefully we can have this conversation with a bit more, a few more positives to report in a year's time.
Hopefully, yes. Thank you so much, Alice.
Thank you. Bye-bye. That's all for this week. Due to ongoing Formula One, there are still a few disruptions in the schedule, but you can normally catch us on a Saturday on Euronews Albania on our YouTube channel and across all major podcasting platforms. Until next week, Miropafshim.